to you, talking to you. It's better to be seated than left. Thank you. Let's deal with the housekeeping matters. We've got a few apologies from Honorable Minister Khadebe, Honorable Ramatlodi, Minister, Deputy Minister Manamela, and Deputy Minister Dozo. I understand she's off sick. DP, I'm correct. DG, I'm correct here. And yeah, me, those are the apologies that we have received from the table. But I think, Maskole, we must just kindly request members, especially portfolio committee members, to please indicate when they're not going to be available. We can't guess. That in Tombele, if you can take care of your team, it would be very much appreciated. That in doubt.
Yes, but I have indicated through email to you that Honorable Van der Westhuizen and Honorable Marais will be joining us late. They have commitments at their by-elections today in their constituencies. Yeah. And just to forewarn the meeting, I may have to leave at any time when somebody higher above calls. So, but I hope it won't be now.
But that higher person won't send it to Moshuar, I'm sure.
I hope so.
Yeah. Yeah, that reminds me. Thanks very much, Honorable Mtau. Also, Honorable Marvin Dent. He did indicate yesterday, Honorable Dombela. It's just that. Also, yes, formalize it. The other thing that Maskole will need to remind members is that when they apologize from their political parties, but still they need to forward an apology to the side. I don't think the rules, it's only in the House where the rules apply in terms of political parties taking responsibilities of their members. They should ensure that they balance those issues. With that, we're disposed with apologies that will bring us to today's meeting. And the program, I'm sure the presenters do have the program before them. Let me see. Which is the one that you are noticing? You must have this one. You must have this one. Fungile, can you just make copies so that I can use this one? This one is more accurate because we have also allocated time so that we don't also cut presenters in the middle of their presentation. It becomes much untidy. But also in terms of time, because members have receive the documents on time, which we really appreciate. There is a great improvement on that one. We really appreciate that one. We will start with Public Service Commission. You've got only 10 minutes for your presentation. No, listen. And 10 minutes, if I'm in good space, I'll give you additional 10 minutes. But also the purpose of the presentation, which is more for briefing, but also to take on board in terms of how do we intend to walk the talk in terms of the NDP, because it seems also to address the matter that we'll be addressing us. Before that, let me just take Honorable Dombe. Can you just step? Okay. Oh, okay. Okay, Honorable Velma, we're looking at the agenda. Yes, they're not here. Yeah, but at least you do have that agenda. Program, she doesn't have. Okay, let's give it to her then. No, the one with the time. Yes, no, just... We didn't send it to her. Okay, next time, Honorable Members, what we're going to do, we'll send it to all of us so that... we don't disadvantage honorable members in particular in terms of time, but also, Maskole, if we can also send to the department so that also in terms of their mindset, they should also program how much time do they have and what to cut off. Having said that, I'll Public Service Commission, DG, or Daten Tembu, you'll introduce the purpose, which is more of linked to the purpose that is to brief the committee in the work that you have been doing, and also to say how do you link it with NDP, because also NDP talks to what we are doing, and also even our act that governs public services, it may. That's all. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and honorable members of the Portfolio Committee on Public Service Administration, as well as monitoring and evaluation. Thank you very much, Chairperson, for giving us this opportunity to brief this Portfolio Committee. But perhaps before I explain, as requested, I need to introduce one of the commissioners who have joined us from the only province in South Africa that is having two names, KwaZulu-Natal, in the person of Dr. Sithole. She is a provincial commissioner in KZN, and she's also a convener of the specialist team monitoring and evaluation, that branch which actually has come out with this particular product which we are going to present today. I'm sure with Dr. Kuvane, you are familiar with our DG, and I'm sure you are also familiar with our parliamentary liaison officer, Nozinko. Thank you. Honorable Chairperson, this presentation which I present to you, that is the study we've conducted of building a capable and career-oriented and professional public service. Thank you. Arises from the National Development Plan. The PSC was of the view that much has been talked about with developmental state, and we felt that as a point of departure, it is important that we clarify ourselves what exactly do we mean when we talk of a developmental state, because there are various conceptions around it. In the view of the PSC, from the comparative studies which we have conducted by those countries which are referred to as developmental states, we came to the conclusion that essentially a developmental state is the one, firstly, which is having a capability to develop or to design national development goals. And then secondly, not only just to define, but equally important, has got the capability of implementing them effectively without any hindrance, so that now those national socio-economic national goals are actually realized. Now, having now defined that, we then move on from the comparative studies. What exactly are those key elements that characterizes developmental states which were very successful, especially in the so-called the Eastern Giants and others in the East? Of course, briefly, Brazil or those countries which fell within what we call a middle developing countries. Now, that now essentially brought us to the key issue which characterizes them, is that they are having a capable public service. A capable public service is essentially characterized by the fact that it is professionalized. And therefore, we look into what are the key features that characterizes them. So hence we talk of an orientated public service, essentially which is professionalized. Now we look at the key component of this, and this is will be the crux of our presentation. We look at the broadly it will be the question of pre-training as well as continuous in-service training, the issue of internship, the issue of profession, the issue of requirements for appointment, you know, etc., etc. And then, of course, the issue of performance management. So there are various key components which will be elaborated when a presentation is made. So in our view, we are of the opinion that if we are to succeed in realizing the national development plan or Vision 30, which in our view is actually a constitutional imperative, which seeks to realize the vision which we have defined in our constitution, that is moving towards the creation and the construction of the South African society, which is based on the democratic principles of social justice, equality, human dignity, and human rights, which are well expatiated in Chapter 2 of our Constitution. In our view, the National Development Plan seeks to realize that goal, and therefore, if we are to realize it, we're making a number of recommendations which in our view, if they're taken very seriously, are being implemented. We hope that with the passage of time, we'll move forward towards realizing that goal. But we also want to point out that it is very, very critical to realize that now.
So one second, Tim. Honorable Velma, what you have dealt with, one was the issue of the program, which we have just given you the hard copy in terms of time allocation. Mr. Mtembe have introduced his colleague, Ms. Futole, from KZN Commissioner in terms of the province. And he's just laying the foundation in terms of the presentation, which areas, what informs the presentation in terms of a capable career of choice in terms of public service, well-capacitated and a professional, efficient public service as it were. Thank you. We may proceed
again. Thank you. Now, a point I want to emphasize is this, that we must take note of the fact that now we don't have much time. We have defined Vision 2030, and this time is 2016, which means we are left with 14 years. And the first phase of the implementation of this vision started with a mid-term strategic framework, the five-year period, that is from 2014 to 2019 or 20. So this has been defined as the first phase towards the realization of Vision 30. And it is defined in terms of the medium-term strategic framework with 13 outcomes, and those outcomes, we are informed, has actually found its way in the various clusters of the department. So there is an agency to look into these recommendations we are putting forward, and we'll appreciate it if they are implemented. Some of them have already been implemented, because these are discussion documents. We are not imposing, but we believe that the Public Service Commission can influence policy change and direction for the development of our country. So that, in a nutshell, is what we seek to achieve with this presentation, and we appreciate the engagement thereafter. Having said that, I'll then request Mrs. DG is going to make a presentation. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson.
Over to you, DG. You've got minus 5 in terms of the time allocated for PSC.
Thanks very much, Chairperson, and Honorable Chair of the Portfolio Committee and Honorable Members. The presentation, as you have heard from the preamble by the Chairperson of the Public Service Commission, it is structured in the following way. Of course, we'll have introduction, and then we'll talk about the basic tenets of the public service, and then which are five, and then we'll conclude. I think, Honorable Chair, what we would like to emphasize, as the Chairperson has indicated, is that the National Development Plan emphasizes the professionalization of the public service, and I think through this document, the Public Service Commission is attempting to really ensure that professionalization takes place indeed. I think the Public Service Commission in this discussion document talks about a values-driven public service. And in this regard, the view is that the central theme and the project for the public service is the promotion of the constitutional values outlined in Section 1.9 and the Bill of Rights and the public administration values in Section 195. I think honorable members should be well vested with this particular particular principles, but the key to that one is the one that talks about the developmental state, that the public service of the Republic should be developmental oriented. I think what we have done with the basic tenets with the Commission was to problematize those basic tenets that we have identified and then propose a possible solution in each of them. And then with the first one, we were talking about that the public service should be a career of choice. We have the view that currently the career development in the public service seems not to be structured well enough to enable the transfer of skills from one department to another. And then we further on say employees seem to move from one job to another in the public service and many a times on promotion before becoming proficient in a particular job. And I think I've just identified those two problematic areas that we have problematized so that when I propose or I raise some of the possible solutions that the PSC is proposing, we can be able to understand. I think it is in that background that we say, based on those areas, the Public Service Commission is saying there should be an introduction of a public service specific internship. I think we do know that currently there are internships that are provided in the public service in a whole range of disciplines. But we have the view that if we can be able to have a public service specific internship and with a possible name that we are suggesting as public administration and management intern. And in through this one, we are saying the internship should prepare candidate for eventual entry into the middle management after serving a prescribed period in an occupation that serves as a feeder for MMS. In other words, we're saying the entry requirement for such internship should be a three-year degree or diploma. I think honorable members will note that in an effort to professionalize public service, then the key issue should be how do we ensure that those who enter public service are well capacitated and well prepared to be really effective in that regard. And we also suggest that during the internship period, the intern should receive training and experiential learning in a specific scope of work, after which the intern's proficiency in that work of that scope of work should be certified. In other words, we will have interns who are certified to be able to enter the public service accordingly. I think what we also propose here is something that we have learned in other countries, that to enter public service, there are exams that are set, and then all public servants who enter public service or candidates who enter public service write exams. And then we're saying the PSC should investigate the introduction of entry exam or that test for entry into occupation that serves as a feeder for the MMS. But it's a view that we're proposing that if it is considered and succeed and approved, it can create that professional public service. I think what we also want to do here, we'll let, because of the honorable members have the presentation, I would like to move to the next basic tenet that we have identified. That is the one on performance management. But we want to problematize that, and when we problematize it, one of the things that we have identified is that the performance management system, as it is, should be evaluated against its own objectives or purpose. The stated objectives of the performance management system is that it should facilitate the improvement of service delivery. This is one key area that currently we say it has got some challenges. And then we propose, we say performance management has been reduced to formal procedures and in the process de-emphasize the values of public service that should underlie all the public administration processes. And then to this end we say we are proposing the following, that there should be, there's a need to undertake an evaluation of the effectiveness of the system against its own stated objectives. Change should be based on a thorough review of the assumptions and the effects of the system, and therefore we should undertake a comparative study which is based on literature review on performance management systems in other countries. And a number of options for changes in individual staff assessment should be suggested. And in this regard, we suggest to one to say much more use of objective external assessment of service units can also be considered. I think once we have identified it, we say it is recommended that effective management structures aligning responsibility, authority, and accountability, and effective performance management systems at the unit level be designed for a number of prioritized service delivery units where uptight structures or systems can be reviewed across the public service based on the lessons learned from the exercise. And hopefully with the understanding of the review of the current performance management system, some of the issues that the Public Service Commission is proposing, they can strengthen that particular system so that we do have an effective performance management system in the public service. I think we also want to recommend that the nature of the incentive and reward in the public service should be fundamentally rethought. We do note and know that half of the time, most of the officials, when we talk about performance management, they are geared to think of a particular merit award or a performance bonus to a point where they no longer consider what they have delivered in terms of service delivery and effectiveness thereof. Some of the officials sometimes, when they do their performance management, they even look at a calculator on the left to say, am I going to get a score that will allow me to get a merit award? And I think from the Public Service Commission point of view, we're discouraging that to say a rethought or rethink or review of this can be able to strengthen the performance in the public service. The next area that we have identified as the Public Service Commission is the political administrative interface. And I think we have a number of points that we've regarded as challenges. And I think one of them would be the demarcation between accountability for policy issues and the accountability for administrative matters should not be oversimplified. And then although the Constitution provides for the appointment of a number of persons or policy considerations, say on Section 194, such as deployments are restricted to Deputy Director General and Director General and to ministerial advisors. And then we talk about the fact that the best performing institutions are characterized by stability of leadership and policy approach, whilst poor performance is associated with a high turnover. And I think here we say there are a number of these challenges that come through as a result of the relationship between the political heads and the administrative heads. And then we say, based on this analysis, we begin to say assignment of powers regarding recruitment, appointment, and performance management, transfer and dismissal, and other career incidents of employees can be relooked. And to this end, we say we can amend, or we're proposing amendment of Section 37 of the Public Service Act to assign powers with regard to career incidents of public servants below the level of DDG to the HOD. In other words, we are saying those that could be set from level 14 and below, they can be assigned to the head of the department in terms of the approval of appointment instead of being at the level of the accounting officers. And we do note that the DDG and HOD ones are the ones that are dealt with at the cabinet level. And then we say, we propose that there could be a consideration of the appointment of administrative head of the public service and therefore a hybrid to top appointments. In this regard, we say to implement the NDP, which proposes that there should be a creation of administrative head of the public service and a hybrid of approach to the top amendments can be considered. We know that it could be an assignment that is still further down the track in terms of being implemented, but efforts under in this process should be considered to be implemented. And the powers of the administrative head of the public service should be restricted to managing the career incidents of heads of departments in the public service. In other words, it will have been removed away from EAs, but to this particular level. I think just to move on to come to the next area that the Commission has identified, which has to do with the capacitation or training and its funding in the public service. I think just to highlight one or two areas that we have identified as challenges with the current arrangement, we say many public servants have tertiary qualifications, and I think the position of the Public Service Commission, Honourable Members, is that if we talk about the public servants, they are highly qualified in our current dispensation. We might just talk about whether with that level of qualification, what about the skills and competencies. But in terms of the levels of education, we have the view that the public service is really highly qualified. However, university degrees and diplomas do not prepare candidates sufficiently for tasks required of public service occupation. And I think we can use an example to say, if we do have one lawyer who has graduated from any top university in this country or whatever university, but when one walks into any public service department to really draft a public submission of any note, it might require a different reorientation, because the university's qualifications compared to the public service administration, they are two different worlds. So we have the view that there is a need to ensure that the universities prepare public servants or graduates who are likely to walk into the public service in order to be able to deliver the services accordingly. So there's a need to reorient our university curriculum to ensure that they are geared and tailor-made to ensure that they help graduates to deal with the challenges that we have in the country. I think the next point that we must just identify in this regard is that the training part starts at the university or other university institution and continue with the employer. Completing the training path logically requires a close partnership between the tertiary institutions and the employer. In this regard, the employer is the government, is the public service. So there must be that relationship that is geared to prepare the candidates accordingly. And I think what we all end up recommending is just to have one of them is that much closer link between the scope of work of the occupation and training curriculum is very, very important indeed. And therefore, the funding model for the School of Government that we have, for example, that it should be looked at, because the School of Government, which is now geared to prepare those who are in the public service, to induct those who are in the public service, therefore should also be looked at so that it is strengthened based on the needs of the those who come into the public service. I think, honourable members, just to conclude here, we say since the publication of this discussion document that we are sharing with the portfolio committee today, the Minister for Public Service and Administration has issued a directive on compulsory capacity development, mandatory training days, and minimum entry requirements for senior managers in terms of public service. And then, therefore, we have the view that, as the chairperson has indicated, some of the things that we've raised, they are already being taken up by the Public Service Administration as the policy-making department to include some of those, and we're pleased with that. And this addresses some, but not all, of the PSC's recommendation. And the PSC will surely follow up on some of its recommendations so that we can operationalize them through some of the projects, so that we can continue to propose some measures or even policy areas that can be considered. The PSC will continue to engage with the National Planning Commission, the National School of Government, Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, and of course, Public Service Administration to strengthen development and oversight of the public service. I think we conclude by saying we look forward to the consideration of this discussion document. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DG. Honourable members, here is the presentation. Can we engage on it? In terms of questions or points of clarity. Honourable Ntau, I'll start from the end.
Thank you, Chair. I keep on saying this. I'm going to begin sounding like a stuck record. You know, after 20 odd years of being in the new democracy and the systems in place and stuff like that, it still amazes me that we are still discussing what I would consider the rudimentary fundamental precepts of what we should do to run anything, you know, a government or a business or anything like that. Having said that, yes, indeed, this has to be welcomed. What I'm really saying when I start is that why has it taken so long for something like this to happen? You know, because if I were to give you my example, I started my work in the municipality in Atteridgeville as a bookkeeper. I wasn't a bookkeeper. I went out of my trick with the, I could read and write and add. But the employer trained me. By the time I left, many years later, I was chief cashier, chief this or chief that, because they trained us all the time. But it seems like this was an area that has always been neglected and should be that. My concern right now is you're saying this is a discussion document. The minister has already taken some action regarding that. What does it mean, discussion document? These are proposals. Who's going to adopt them? Who's going to accept them? What's the process going forward? that should make sure that these things become entrenched, so that what you were talking about earlier and what the chair was talking about earlier, professionalization and implementation, the implementation part does take place. On a more philosophical level, I believe one of the biggest challenges you have, and when I say you, it's the Public Service Commission, monitoring and evaluation and all of these things, people who should do that in terms of reorientation of the public service, is reorientation of the people who want to take up careers in the public service. That they are being employed in the public service should not depend on having a membership card of a political party. One of the biggest problems we have in this country today is that people get employed because they belong to this political party and not the other one. So what are you guys going to do about that? Because a career in the public service should be about people who are in the public service, not the DA service or the ANC service or the EFF service or anybody for that matter. I'd like to give you this example. When George Bush Jr. lost the presidency to Obama, there was a lot of talk about what he was going to do or not do with his senior staff and stuff like that. And he called these people and he said, guys, the results are in, we've lost the election, all I'm going to ask you to do is go in, continue to do your jobs that you've done under me because you are public servants. I don't feel we have that capacity in this country yet, so you have this job to deal with. The other one, on a philosophical level, is this notion, well, it's no longer a notion because it's in the documents of the government, of a developmental state. Now, when you talk to many people about a developmental state, the connotation is socialism, communism, and that seems to impact negatively on the thinking of other people. So, listening to you now and the chair, indeed, that's what needs to be done, so that people understand exactly what it means, that the public service should be orientated towards developing the country in the best interest of the country, to grow the economy, to create jobs, to do all those things that you do. It has nothing to do with socialism or communism, and those things need to actually be spelled out emphatically among the people in this country, because they seem to have preconceived notions about that. My bugbear, Chair, you know, I always say, you know, the Public Service Commission is a very good institution, and it should be there, and it should be done, and we always worry about the fact that you don't have teeth, and that's why we were looking at that bit of legislation to give you a little bit of muscle. Now you said it again. We are not imposing. In other words, you come up with this idea and stuff like that, we put on a proposal with that. We are not imposing, all right? We would like to have this thing adopted. We would like to have this thing implemented. How are you going to achieve that? Because good as some of the proposals are, to have effect, we need to actually make sure that these things happen. The NDP gets implemented. That's what we need. I'll stop there.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Tao. Honorable Velma.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. The one point I'm linking to is the universities. Universities have public service studies, if I can loosely call that. I want to know the relationship between our tertiary institutions, universities, and the Public Service Commission. Is there a relationship? Has there been discussion and agreements between you and universities? I studied overseas, so I'm not that au fait in terms of how it works here. In overseas, you have a four-year degree. At any time, be in the first, second, or fourth year, one can take an internship. That's how it works. So they have, in America, they have the three-month summer holiday, for example, where that can then take place. If they're going to specialize in public service, they will have 2 days a week working in government. sorry, I mustn't say working, I have an internship in government. Or in the capital. Then, in the middle of the third year, the full summer break, they have to then work wherever in government they are then going to be work. If one looks at South Africa and one looks at social workers, I'm a social worker, so let me just speak from that experience. In the second or the third year, one goes and spends time in different agencies or then NGOs. If one specializes then in then one looks at 2 days a week, or let's call that in practicals within the NGO sector. What are we looking at in terms of the public service sector? Do we have that during that time of study, or do we have that only after you have qualified and graduated? But during the study time at the university, is there anything? Is that being discussed between yourselves and the tertiary institutions? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Bergman, we must say thank you after we have finished so that I don't think you are still coming back. It will help. Honourable Tombe.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Thanks for the presentation to members of the PSC. Chairperson, I think we are living in a changing world. It is not static, and it will never be static. So the changing world that we are living in is so dynamic that it demands of us to look into our set of values as we try to address the new demands that crop up. To an extent that for us to survive, if we need to change our mindset in order to address demands of a new world order, so be it. I am therefore saying I do not find fault with the ongoing research and investigations of better methods of doing things, of how we do things. But what I want to raise is, what then do we do with the current crop of the public service servants or employees who were not or who would not necessarily be trained in the current method that is envisaged? That is in terms of the recommendations that have been raised. Are we going to retrain them? Or how do we make sure that they still remain relevant to our objectives of realizing our 2030 objective? And as we continue doing that, Chair, how do we position the concept of the school of government such that it becomes strengthened and it becomes an imperative route towards the attainment of the kind of a public service cadre that we are looking for? Because we might have good recommendations, but I would say it would be dangerous to look at them outside the plan that we have of the School of Government. So we should always keep it in mind that we have a School of Government. We want to strengthen it, and we want to make it a thought leader, so to speak. I'm worried about the School of Government. How do we strengthen its role in our local dispensation? Thank you, Chair.
Okay, members and PSC, we must note that we are 5 minutes brief, which has gone past. That's one. Two, the principal understanding of this portfolio committee that the some of the responses will come in writing. Let me then take my bite. That some of the issues that Honorable Velma and Honorable Dombela you have raised in terms of our BRRR report, it captures that in terms of the School of Governance to ensure that there are courses or trainings are accredited, and also re-business orientation of the School of Governance in terms of the business angle, because they need also to develop their own, generate their own revenue. So that we have, at least it has gone through the house, which means that coming back next year we should monitor that, how far are we in terms of the department implementing that. It's just to recap for members also things that we have already addressed. Two for me is the I think Honorable Mdawi, you'll agree with me that taking the just immediate case of Eku Ruleni, where the DA in terms of mayoral ship is leading, they've got a new city manager, and within a 3 month period, city manager is in place, the new one. So some of the things that some of us will raise, it depends which side of the table are you seated at any, or at what time are you. So I'm raising that so that Datem Tembo, you don't respond to the political issues, you respond to the core function and mandate of the public services, it were. I think it will help us. But having said that, in terms of your recommendations, I would suggest, because the purpose of today was the presentation, so that we can know how far we are. I want to assume that we have already made a presentation to the cabinet. It has gone through the cabinet. That's why we are able also to implement some of the areas. But you confirm that. Two, also, unfortunately, the purpose of today was not for us to make recommendations, because some of the recommendations are for the executive. So when we are coming back, I'm suggesting now, honorable members, that in the second quarter of 2017, when they come back, they must come back with a clear recommendation for the portfolio committee. We normally ask you what you want from us. It must be very clear. It must not be somewhere within the midst of the whole presentation. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with today's one, because the purpose was very clearly, but it will help. That's a third point. And the other one, in terms of ensuring that the other one that I would like you to engage the CETA, public sector CETA, and also NSG, is the issue that some of us have been raising of making sure that on-job training is recognized, is graded. Because certificates and qualifications sometimes doesn't match the performance of the individual, unfortunately, at the end of the day. But I'm saying people must go to school, but also how Honorable Ndawu has managed to grow up the ladder in where he was working, the exam that he made, is because it was on job training. That's why he got promoted. Unfortunately, it was not recognized as he can apply for that unless he's got a certificate for that. And I'm saying we must deal with that one. But also I'm sure, honorable members, the issues of management in terms of, because why we're not doing what you're supposed to do, the issue of management, and I'm sure Public Service Commission should also assist us in that area, how do we force the DGs to manage their immediate subordinates so that the whole then hierarchy going down administratively does perform what it's supposed to perform to do. Kindly just summarize in 2 minutes according to my watch, then we'll close, the other responses will follow. I'll give it to Dadem Tembu if you want to summarize, Dadem Tembu, but I would like to hear the voice, because you said also she's the commissioner responsible for this space that we're dealing with. But over to you, Chair.
I'll simply respond to one question raised here, and then I'll ask my colleague to respond to. Yeah, I think, why do we say this is a discussion document? and recommendations. I think it is important to understand that now, post 94, specifically 1996, there was a new constitution. And then the current Public Service Commission, unlike the previous one before 1994, it does not have executive or policy-making powers. Now, in 1996, for the first time, we had what we call a Department of Public Service and Administration. We did not have that before then, which meant that now the Public Service Commission, in terms of the new constitution of 1996, is an oversight body. Constitutionally, we can advise, we can recommend. In certain instances, with personnel issues, we can issue directions. Now, here, we want to influence policy, but because we're not a policy-making body, the only thing that we can do when we observe certain weaknesses in public administration, we conduct a research, and this is what is done, a comparative study. We then make recommendations, and we try to persuade through argumentation and what we are doing now, so as to influence policy. That is the reason why it is a discussion document. This is in terms of what you call a separation of powers. You know, there are those people who make policy, who execute policy, and we constitutionally we have to make recommendations and try to persuade. That is the reason we do this. Now we say you as a portfolio committee, you have got specific powers, and we can also lobby you so that now we can also influence those who are making policy, because part of your work, you know, although not strictly, but lawmaking to a certain extent, it defines the policy. So that's the reason that now we make these recommendations to you, to politicians. I'm sure the DG has pointed out we're going to engage in the various key stakeholders to try and influence it, so that now our guys, our peers, can calculate and find their way in policy making and influence the direction which the country is taking.
Thank you, Professor. I take comfort in that you are inviting us to make written presentations of some of the comments, because some of the philosophical questions that are coming out of here can take some time. But I do want to say that when you look at our report, it's very intricately linked. All of these issues that DG was presenting, they are intricately linked in such that you cannot look at each one of them in isolation. And they eventually answer some of the issues related to where are we as South Africa and why it is to zoom into these, particularly these five things. If you look, for example, at the question as to why now, our universities themselves admit, and they have admitted when we have engaged them on this particular project, that they were theory-based, that it is only recently that they are getting a push into being experiential in the manner in which they craft out their learning programs. The manner in which our departments in government have been inducting and upgrading, or rather promoting, their officials is discipline orientated. It has nothing to do with the bigger picture that you might be a doctor but you will eventually become a CEO and eventually need management skills. So what we are doing here with this citing performance management that is much more localized in terms of looking at the issues that you are faced with, citing internship that enforces public administration and management at a very early stage, is to look at all of these things and produce the kind of public servant that is not only an architect, but that can look into servicing public service and management. So I'm not going to go question by question, but all I am pleading, even before we do our written submissions, our responses, is to say it's a very, very deliberate selection of issues that we've raised, and they relate to where South Africa is and the kinds of inheritance of knowledge silos that we had in our universities and in our government. That is how and why we are proposing things in a particular way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
No, we are taking the cue from Utapi and Tim.
Yeah.
I think, DG, I would request that we take that angle, unless that Mta wants to chip in. I can see that somewhere. Now I understand your body language very well.
I just wanted to say, actually, I was probing because I wanted to hear where the commission was going, and what I'm hearing is encouraging. Yes. But here's some breaking news. Donald Trump has won.
Oh, don't say it loud. Serious?
What can I say?
Oh, no. Hey, Americans are full of surprises,
oh, yeah,
I'm telling
are.
You. Very surprising. Honorable Donald.
Thank you very much, Chair. At least some level of sanity will come to Americans, ultimately.
After 5 years.
After 5 years, because of the new leadership that's about to take America. Okay, let's hope for the best. Chair.
Let's come back here.
Yeah. Ubaba Mthembu has spoken about the fact that it's only 14 years to go towards 2030. I'm just wondering, thinking aloud, are we in a position, with all the plans that we have, are we in a position to realize our objectives come 2030? What are the possibilities of realizing our goal with all the plans that we have?
I think it might have been dealt with
in my absence.
Not necessarily. I'm worried if he's going to speculate for the future. Because that one also it lies squarely on our shoulders. How do we do our oversight role and make the executive accountable, really accountable as well? But do respond to that one, and I'll close now, because this one it's not necessarily on the presentation per se. It's to say, how do we measure our performance as a country moving forward again?
No.
I'm saying Ubaba Mthembu said it's only 14 years towards 2030, which are the realization of our objectives in as far as the NDP is concerned.
Mm.
Now we have the public service as the integral part of our plans. Now, as time goes on, they're able to pick up certain problems and propose and make recommendations. And make recommendations that would put the current department in a better state. So I am saying that could have an effect on the on the timeline that we have. What is their take on that? I would like to hear what the PSC says about that.
Okay, that one, yeah. He needs it today and now.
Okay. Yeah, I'll try to respond to that one. I think what you are saying, I've said in my introduction remarks, there is an agency. And I've also pointed out that now this is the first phase, and we've identified 13 outcomes, which have been translated to the medium-term strategic framework, and then departments were instructed to implement the first phase. You know, ministers have entered into agreement with the president, and then the ministers in turn must enter into performance agreement with the HODs, and then it cascades down to all the public servants. Now, we have got a system of performance management development system to measure the extent to which now we are moving towards the end. Because all the plans are informed by the medium-term strategic plan, where in terms of outcomes as introduced in 2010 or 11. Now, part of the challenge is that the performance management and development system has got some challenges. And then hence we are saying that there is a need to assess its effectiveness, whether are we really achieving that. Now, my take is that come 2019, we need to assess, and this is what as a PSC independently, to assess the extent to which the first phase of the implementation of the National Development Plan, to what extent have we really achieved it. Right, that's point number one. But point number two, there are challenges which you can explain. You can plan, but there are certain reasonable challenges. One of the challenges is that our economy is not doing well. The plan is premised on the fact that the economic growth will be about 5.4%. But as you know, the minister has just said it's just less than 1%. It has forced the minister to cut down on certain programs. We focus only on social programs as well as especially education because of the crisis.
Of time.
Sure.
The more you explain that in terms, I'm sorry to do this, the more I'm tempted that we need to look at how do we dedicate a day on this one, because also DPME needs to respond. We need to jointly respond to that, not only Public Service Commission, to say how do we then, because mind you, our term ends in 2019. So when you review in 2019, we won't be here, and we want to leave a legacy that we can feel in touch for on behalf of our communities. So I'm suggesting that in your question, that it don't matter, because it's an interdepartmental response than just Public Service Commission. Having said that, thank you so much, PSC. We are one family. Yeah, at liberty to remain or to leave. Next time, we'll start with the DPSA, so that you'll be the last one in terms of presentation, so that you don't leave early. Yeah. Oh, okay. I saw you folding your papers. it's DPSA now.
Yes.
In terms of the regulations, I will add, honourable members, in terms of time. Unfortunately, I will try to be slightly harsher because I know that Mtau indicated to leave early. I know that Dongola has got a meeting to attend to. You just request to be excused. Not now. We are left with 1 hour to be with us. Did you take us through the presentation in terms of regulations, just to recap why you are bringing them back here, in the ambit of the ministry and the department to implement them, but we wanted also to get a sense of comfort in terms of the consultation, in terms of the people that is going to be affected with the new regulations that are responding to the Public Service Act that was signed by the minister in 2014 December, towards the end of December. Secondly, you promised us that you are going to implement them incrementally in terms of areas. How far are we on that in terms of what kind of reaction are we getting in terms of our workforce? Are we winning or what? How do we intend also to make sure that everybody does buy in, which is very important. Over to you, PG, and your team.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Council members, Chair of the Public Service Commission, Commissioner, my colleagues. I'm joined here by the Deputy Director General responsible for Search and Policy and Public Luck, and our ETA, the Minister of Service Commission, and I am the Chief of Staff, Chairman, and Special Advisor to our Minister. This presentation, Honorable Chair, will focus on, because at the moment there are two sets of regulations that we've been working on. The one set is updating the regulations for the Public Service Act to assist with the implementation of the Public Service Act. But the committee will recall that you also have the PEM Act, and that there is a process of developing regulations for the PEM Act. The first set of regulations is out already for comment, and as it seems now, we are already working on the second set of regulations. But what Relation will do is to talk about how we have tried to strengthen the implementation of the Public Service Act itself by amending the regulations that were already in place. Still with a number of things, but needed to be strengthened. Things such as the committee has said in the past, but you've got the e-disclosure system, for example, but the regulations were still talking to the manual disclosure. So they had to be amended so that we then talk about the e-disclosure system in the regulations as well. So it's a number of those kinds of issues around strengthening the implementation of the Public Service Act through the amendment of the regulations themselves. With your permission, Chairperson, I'll ask Mr. Naidu to take members through the presentation.
Okay, before that, welcome, Honourable Member. We did receive your apology. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Okay, over to you, Member.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. Thank you, DG. I think just as a quick overview of what we've done and why we've done what we've done, I think it's important to understand why we had to amend the public service regulation. In 2008, we brought into effect the Public Service Amendment Act.
My due, we are not the new committee. We started to be here in 2014. So the preamble of the history, that's why I will try to recap so that we can fast track and zoom in the purpose of the regulation. Thank you. Because you are only left with 10 minutes now as the department.
That Amendment Act brought in some changes that needed us to align the public service regulations to it. There were also amendments to the LRA and the Employment Equity Act that required alignment to the regulations. The current fiscal constraints that the public service is under also necessitated alignment to the regulations. Anti-corruption mechanisms needed to be focused on, and those are now contained in the revised regulations. There were undertakings and amendments from the collective bargaining processes that also required the regulations to be amended. These regulations of 2016 repealed the previous public service regulations of 2001 and came into effect on the 1st of August 2016 after an extensive consultation process. Workshops have since been undertaken at both the national and provincial level and have been widely accepted in terms of its content. Just to note also that the regulations have been tabled already in Parliament. I'm just going to go quickly through the content of the regulation. Chapter 1 deals with your general provisions, which basically deals with the repeal of the 2001 regulation, the powers of the minister to approve deviations, the Z forms and so forth. I don't think there's too much that we need to focus on there. The code of conduct in terms of Chapter 2 is where there was a lot of focus placed. The amended code of conduct creates a prohibition on doing business with the state, and this now prohibits employees from doing business with the state, and is aligned very much with Section 8 of the Public Administration Management Act, and it seemed to be a transitional mechanism towards us implementing the Public Administration Management Act as well. Noting that when the Public Administration Management Act is effected, doing business with an organ of state will amount to a criminal offense. While under the Public Service Act, it will remain a disciplinary matter. A transitional measure has been put in place to deal with employees who are, as of the 1st of August 2016, doing business with the state. The provisions on financial disclosure, as the DG has said, has been amended to allow for the e-disclosure system, and it allows for the minister to prescribe particular forms that will be used. On the issues of anti-corruption and ethics management, which is in Part 3 of Chapter 2, it places huge obligations on an HOD in terms of assessing risks, finding strategies, implementing those strategies, and so forth. There's also a path that is now being set for outside remunerative work, in terms of Section 30, which now requires that all new applications will follow a particular prescribed format in terms of its approval process, as well as in terms of the form that will be completed when employees actually apply to do RWAP. Chapter 3 deals with broadly the planning, organizational arrangements and service delivery. What Part 1 has done, it has provided for various plans that are required in terms of the department's reporting system. And they've articulated very completely what will be contained in each of those plans, like your strategic plan, your HR plan, and so forth. On organizational and functional arrangements, this basically talks about your organizational form, when new departments are created, what happens in terms of its concomitant resources, that's the employees, the posts, the assets, and so forth. How government components and specialized service delivery units are configured is also prescribed in terms of the regulations, the processes that need to be followed before those particular components and service delivery units are established. The organizational functionality assessment has also been introduced in these regulations, and that basically is a tool to assess the internal systems and processes of a department. And the minister will issue a tool in this respect. On service delivery, again, Part 3 deals with specifically service delivery and deals with the plans that will assist service delivery and the institutionalization of the operations management framework, the service delivery charter, and the SDI. I think the biggest focus in terms of our cost containment and the alignment to the LRA you will find in Chapter 4, which deals with the employment matters. Provision is now made for post-provisioning norms and standards to be determined by the Minister. And these post-provisioning norms will take into account the size of a department, the responsibility of units and supervisors versus subordinates, etc. So it will give departments guidance on their structures. The idea of these provisions as well is to remove disparities that exist within the public service. And the way that we seek to do that is that we allow the Minister for Public Service and Administration to centrally grade specific posts that occur transversely within the public service. And once the Minister has done that, EAs are not allowed to job evaluate those particular posts. That will allow a system that allows similar posts to be graded similarly throughout the public service. The same with OSDs. We know that it emanated through collective bargaining processes, and that continues to exist. The provision is made in the regulation for OSDs. On the issues of setting of higher salaries, this is another mechanism where we want to rationalize the public service to the extent that we want to pay people the value of the work that they do. So we want to eradicate those higher salaries for similar jobs. And the way that we do it is that we place mechanisms and criteria on the awarding of higher salaries, either through counter offers or through offers for recruitment, so that they can't be arbitrary and devoid of the actual job content. On the regrading of posts, we've also had to provide regulations and update these regulations in terms of what happens to incumbents of posts where posts are affected by job grading. And one of the fundamental changes that we've made is that we now prohibit the placing of people additional to the establishment when jobs are degraded. So there are provisions there that require that you either redesign the job or you transfer incumbents to adequately and suitably suitable positions. On remuneration and other benefits, not much has changed there. In terms of your general conditions of employment, I think the big change here is that where previously people, EAs were allowed to appoint people additional to the establishment for periods that were not limited. We have now limited those periods. So you may, if you appoint people as a result of an increase in job or as a result of the absence of a particular employee, such appointments additional to the establishment are limited to 12 consecutive months. Of course, we recognize there are some departments that may have operational reasons that require a longer period, and for that we've built in a proviso that the minister can approve a longer period. We've also built in now a provision that requires that even posts additional to the establishment are required to be subjected to job evaluation. So the fact that you appoint someone not in a post does not mean that you can, you do not pay them a salary that's commensurate of the function. The issue of unpaid voluntary workers was a new issue that was brought in by the Amendment Act, and what we've done is we've provided regulations for the proper implementation of that particular provision. The Amendment Act further brought in a prohibition on the re-employment of former employees who were dismissed for misconduct. And what Regulation 61 does is that it creates varying periods under which an employee may not be reappointed if such an employee was dismissed for misconduct. The most serious misconduct creates a prohibition period of 5 years, and the least serious, a minimum of 1 year. So what that means is that any given point, if an employee services are terminated as a result of misconduct, they will not be allowed to enter the public service at least a minimum of 1 year. Secondment, we have again provided a limitation on the period of secondment, again with the latitude that the minister may approve a longer period should EAs require same, but they would have to obviously show the rationale for that. We also have built in a provision that an EA, when an employee is seconded, an EA can require that when the employee returns, they continue services for a further period based on the secondment. And of course, this is due, this is with the consent of the employee. On the issues of acting and reassignment, that's under Section 32. We have included a provision that requires that when EAs appoint employees to act in particular positions, they have to ensure that the relevant employee that's acting in that position has the necessary competencies. And that's very important because we've noticed and we've noted that there were concerns raised that employees acting in positions do not have the necessary competencies and therefore make decisions that ultimately prejudice an administration. The determination on the employment of foreign nationals, I think that's clear and that just comes from the Act itself. Advertisements, we have created a provision to try and deal with the huge cost of advertisements departments are facing, especially for similar posts. And what the provision does in these regulations is that it allows you to create a pool arising out of one particular advert. So if you have, for example, 5 administrator posts to be filled in a period of 6 months, you can use a single advert to recruit those particular posts. So it's just a cost-saving mechanism. But obviously it's at the discretion of EAs that they would process it in that particular way. The filling of posts in the office of the ministers and deputy ministers and premiers and MECs is as it was in the 2001 regulations, which allows that employees do not need to follow an open advertisement process. However, new employees cannot be appointed permanently unless they are transferred in terms of Section 14. On the selection process, we have provided specifically for a headhunting process. where normal recruitment processes fail to achieve the results that they should have and no suitable candidate could be identified, we allow that an EA must approve or may approve a headhunting process, but again, it is the EA that must approve that particular headhunting process, subject to, of course, delegation. In terms of probation, the Act, the Amendment Act required the Minister to make regulations to prescribe periods for probation, which has been done extensively in Regulation 68. On the issue of resignations, we have included a provision that allows an employee to withdraw his or her resignation with the approval of the EA, provided that the approval is obtained before the last working day of the employee. And the reason we've done that is that we are inundated with requests where in the heat of the moment employees tender their resignation, and then we are asked to allow them to let them withdraw that. So what we've done through these regulations is we've allowed the EA the discretion to allow the withdrawal of that resignation with the proviso that that employee is still employed at the time. Employee records, nothing's changed there. It's still a requirement to keep those records. In terms of the performance management provision, there was a huge overhaul in terms of the content of what is the requirement. More detail is provided in terms of the systems, when the systems can be changed, the record keeping, what goes into performance agreements, when it should be signed, how it should be signed, assessments, how they should be conducted, when should they be finalized, and so forth. The rewarding of performance has also been regulated to the extent that the minister will create limitations in terms of what can be paid in respect of good performance. On the issues of training, the minister is empowered to make directives regarding the registration of training and the utilization of training budget, as well as the training, the actual training that needs to take place in the public service. In terms of bursaries, there's also extensive provisions in terms of how bursaries are awarded and what happens to bursary holders. Labor matters, it remains the same to the extent that negotiations continue to take place in the fashion that it has been. With the proviso that in terms of the amended Act, there was a requirement that the Minister must issue regulations on the summoning of witnesses to disciplinary hearings, and this has been done in Regulation 80. On the issues of the SMS, the status quo remains. The regulations have been amended to the extent that the Minister is still empowered to issue determinations on the annual cost of living adjustment. This has just been aligned to the collective agreement that was concluded in 2000. On the issues of electronic government and information management, the reference to the MIS has been removed, and that's because it is the domain of the Minister of State Security. However, there is provision that the Minister for Public Service and Administration can tailor-make a minimum information security policy that are not that is not inconsistent with any laws or the MIS itself. Advisory bodies to the minister. This is as a result of Section 3.3, which allows the minister to establish by regulation advisory bodies. We, prior to the 2016 regulations, the minister had two advisory bodies. These regulations taking into account the cost containment aspects of the DPSA has limited this advisory body to now one body that will serve, where the members will serve on a part-time basis as opposed to a full-time basis. on the CDW program, noting that the CDW program has been in existence for a while. Chapter 8 basically sets out what the functions of the CDW and what the aim of the CDW is supposed to be, and it allows for the minister, that's the Minister for Public Service and Administration, after consulting with the Minister of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, to determine a framework for the CDW program. The annexes that are attached to the regulations, those are pretty self-explanatory. They are all of your employment contracts for the SMS, with Annexure 2 being the employment contract for the HOD, which is prescribed. So it is a requirement, it's a mandatory requirement that departments use that particular annexure when they complete the employment contract for HOD. And that brings me to the end of the presentation. Thank you very much.
I thought you were going to read it. Whatever language is written there. But playing safe, it's fine. Thanks so much for the presentation. Honorable members, regulations are here for our information because it's more of an administrative issue, but I'm sure members would like to ask some clarity in terms of the standing of the regulations as presented. I'll start from my immediate, you know, I started that side, I'll start from my immediate right this time around. That didn't obey. He passes Honorable Velma. Questions? Clarity? No, he's fine.
Just one question, Chair. Many departments or committees say that there's too much use of consultants and they need to scale down on that. So the regulations doesn't say anything about the reasons for the use of consultants, because inside the departments they might not have the skills. The regulations say nothing about the skills that are needed, because that's why we get consultants. So now we don't get consultants, we use those skills from the department. Does the regulation say anything about that?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Mdow.
Quick ones, Chair. OSD.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Fund, this is then. Yeah.
Thank you.
Two points from my side. The first one is, we've now heard that the minister, set the implementation date, if I'm correct, as the 1st of August. Does that apply for the full set of regulations except where transitional arrangements are provided for? And then secondly, it seems to me one of the problem areas is still promotions within the public service. Unfortunately, I missed the Public Service Commission's presentation, but looking at the printout, it seems to me that if you want to professionalize the public service, the career development, the career focus, the training, and then but also then promoting the right people into middle and senior management remains a bit of a challenge. And my question is just, does the new set of regulations address this at all? Thank you.
From my side, there's somewhere where you talk about, in terms of your regulations, that the head of the Public Service Commission is chaired by minister. It's not safe with the head, but also with other two ministers, which means you can pick up any minister from on paper if you look at it. And then it includes also the chairperson of the Public Service Commission. Does the Act addresses that, or it's a working relationship within the ministries or inter IMC, or where does it, what does it informed, by what is it informed, that arrangement? That's one. Two, for me also, in terms of you spoke about also the cooling period, if I may use that, those ones who have been expelled, the 5 years and the 1 year one, why do you expel me and you're still going to take me after you have changed your mind in 5 years? Because you would have conducted a very serious offense in the public service. I'm not too sure what was the intention. Oh, you were thinking about yourself that we might fire you and you can come back as a new leaf. But on a serious note, that if you are not performing, also you are undermining the financial protocols and you are mismanaging the money. So why you have to come back to that space? From where I'm sitting, there's actually a very discomfort, I may say. The other one is the issue of, I agree, public servants, they should not be seen being active. But you didn't say the word that in terms of a regulation, it excludes being active. Because everybody goes to vote, and they vote for a party. That's why you go for voting. But being seen active, it should be also that one. I think that word active, for me, it does then indicate. And of course, in terms of other positions, it does say that you must also cease to be a member of the political party. But the active one is not in the regulation. I think it must be, because they can challenge you when they want to go outside and do their own business, to say that, no, you didn't say must be active. How did you find out? The other one that I would like you to just to talk to is the linkages in of the recommendations talking to the abbreviation that Honorable Mtabwe has raised, the OSD, and the court judgment in that space. And also it talks to the abuse of ill health, sick leave rather, but the relationship with the pillar. Because I know with the pillar, the DG is better placed, but was somewhere, the last time we had a presentation on pillar, we didn't finish our discussion, we said they must come back. So is there any synergies in looking at that in implementation of the regulations as well? But also you also the other one, DG, that you, I think you said they were implemented in 1st of August, I assume it's 2016, but you are saying that they're still out for consultation. What does that mean? We haven't started implementing them, but I hope we have some of them, because you promised us that you implement them incrementally. Or we've moved from that one, we're doing a big bang implementation, as it were. Thank you. And only 3 minutes in response on all the things that I've raised in other honorable members. Or second thought. Okay, honorable member Velma.
Thank you, Chair. Just something that I saw, or rather in the next presentation, but because they are covering labour and employment issues, I also want to ask it at this point. The regulations, all HR of every department, have they received training about the changes in the regulations? Because the next presentation they say that is a problem, because they fail to understand the regulations in terms of pensions. So does HR understand the regulations and the impact it has on labour issues? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Over to you. You'll take yours, Tichi, and she'll take hers. But you'll decide who responds between the two of you.
I think in the interest of time, Chair,
thank you, Chair. The use of consultants, we've actually stayed away from it simply because it's a domain of National Treasury, and they seek to deal with that in terms of the PFMA processes, and they currently have processes underway to try and lessen the use of consultants. Noting, of course, that the lack of skills has been an issue that has been a reason why consultants are used so broadly in the public service. But what we've done in the regulations is that we've enhanced the regulations to the extent that it is now a requirement when you advertise jobs to be very clear about what it is those jobs must achieve, what qualifications people need to have when they are appointed and so forth. So we're hoping that those enhanced regulations will address the issue of skills that's required in the public service. On the ZEB form, that's a prescribed form that the minister usually issues. Some of the forms have been inherited from pre-1994. It's like your leave form, your long service form, and so forth. And those continue to exist as prescribed forms. So the format is prescribed and departments use it, and that allows consistent use of specific forms. The OSD is the Occupational Specific Dispensation, which I'm sure you've heard quite a lot about from departments. And those were to deal with specific occupational categories where specific jobs were identified and specific salaries were designated in terms. So it was a centrally determined job dispensation that came out of collective bargaining. The 1st of August 2016 is the implementation date for the entire regulation. So we have, since the 1st of August 2016, repealed the 2001 regulation in its entirety. And so from the 1st of August, we are using these new set of regulations throughout the public service. On the issues of promotions, I think, again, I want to hope that we've addressed the issue of promotions to the extent that we, because of the enhanced, like I said, the enhanced regulations focusing on skills, we are hoping that that will address the issues in terms of promotions and ensuring that you have the correct people at the correct places. The issue of the chairperson being the chairperson of the selection panel, I think that's been an ongoing debate between the Commission and ourselves as the BPSA. We finally resolved the matter. The Public Service Act provides that the chairperson is the executive authority in respect of the Office of the Public Service Commission. And therefore, we have given the chairperson the same responsibility as any other minister in respect of their department. So that's why that regulation is written the way that it is.
Okay.
Yes, we hear you, and we would have loved to have had a total prohibition on the re-employment of people who have performed misconduct. But unfortunately, the way the Act is, maybe fortunately for some, the way the Act is written, it doesn't require, it doesn't allow a total prohibition. That minister can only prescribe periods when people can't return, and to prescribe a period of a total ban will be contrary to the Act itself. And there's been a lot of debate in terms of the period ranging from 5 to 1, and there's been arguments about the rehabilitation of people, and given that we recognize that people change and they have the potential to change.
They get born again.
They get born again. So you don't want to create that total prohibition. So hence the provision. And there was an extensive debate on it. We were back and forth. I mean, even the 5 years we were, you know, just to categorize it was a difficult. It was very challenging. The issues on the political party, I think I'm going to leave to DG. The pillar model as well. I think I've answered most of it, DG.
Yeah, over to DG. Mind you, I don't need a presentation on pillar, but I want to get the relationship, specifically on the sick leave issue that the regulations talk to, just to assist you so that we don't deal with pillar here. One minute is gone then, which means you forfeit.
Just a clarification, the question that you had asked, the Palmer rigs versus the public service rigs, those are separate. So the ones that are under consultation are the ones from Palmer, and that's what has been phased in. And we are dealing with the two sections, which is doing business with government and the e-disclosure, because that also then covers the municipal space as well.
that reminds me then, are there any repercussions in terms of those ones who find them, we find themselves doing business with government without declaring? Because at a certain stage you would like the public servants to stop doing business with government, because they can't be the driver, the passenger and the money collector at the same time. I'm using a township scenario here. Honourable Member, you had your hand up.
Two more issues. The first one is the retirement age. Have you looked at that, and has there been any changes for some people to stay on longer than age 65? And the second one, if I can come back to promotion, at one stage in the public service there was a system whereby people were evaluated in terms of their suitability for promotion. I didn't hear you referring to something like that when you answered the previous question. If you could just, in terms of promotion, how will we ensure in terms of these regulations that only people suitable to perform at a higher level will be eligible to apply for promotion posts? Thank you.
Over to you, DJ. I'm sorry about that. I've got a sharp pain on my back, so I'm just requesting some tablets. I'm sorry about that.
I think in brief, just to indicate that no changes have been introduced in terms of the family. The arrangement that has been is provided for in the Public Service Act, the age of 65, but with the understanding that people can apply for any time, and their provisions are today to assist possibly to the retirement. Of course, this broadly speaking applies the issue of promotion, it used to be called, right? Even later, it's the money. Yeah, where you get money, where you get the money. But at the moment, the only way you get promoted is if there is a post that is higher than the one that you occupy, and you apply, and then you get promoted. The understanding is that having been in the job, you will have had the opportunity to grow and acquire, and therefore stand a good chance of being promoted. But if it's not automated, you will still have to compete with other people who are coming. The chair has raised the issue of scale, but just to indicate that the issues of leave at the moment have not been changed. But there is work that we are doing now in terms of collective bargaining on the leave situation. And that process is ongoing now in the bargaining chamber, tries to rationalize the new situation that is subject to agreement and to support that the pillar process itself, the committee is no longer being reviewed. That we've got a team in place now that can keep a review of the pillar process to identify where they are weaknesses, and we'll come back to us with recommendations on how it can be done.
Thank you so much, members and colleagues. That brings us to, we're not going to get a health break. We'll go to PSC again. Second Tim. On pension payout point. And also I'm sure your presentation also will talk to the relationship of this presentation in terms of the work that you have conducted with the Social Welfare Department as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Now, this assessment was informed by the complaints and grievances we received from retirees. This created the impression that people who have retired are not treated well by government. In other words, we felt that now, if this is true, it's very serious, because it suggests that government is uncaring when someone has served the government for more than 30 years or 40 years,
and then at the end we are not taken care of. Whereas there is a clear legislative framework that takes care of the management before you retire and after retirement, post-retirement. Then the question we sought to answer, to what extent is this really true? And if so, what are the causal factors? And then to make recommendations so that it can be addressed. And to that effect, I will therefore request our Deputy Director General for Leadership and Management Practices in the persons of Ms. Maybe your name?
Sedibe.
No, yes, in a Mazulu, not soon as pronounced. It's a problem. I'm sorry.
It's fine, we're in the same pool.
Sedibe, I'm joking.
Okay. But also just to compliment and to congratulate DG, I can see females are coming and they are opening their mouths. We mostly welcome that. And also you are doing very well, Dakin Tebe, don't change. Just bring them more and they must talk, especially the young ones. Over to you, ma'am.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members of the Committee, Public Service Commissioners and the colleagues. In the interest of time, I will be a bit brief because everybody has read the presentation. And I will move over to slide number 3, which locates the mandate of the PSC in conducting a study of this nature, which we are all aware of because it falls within the domain of the PSC, monitoring, providing advice, and looking at issues of personnel practices and the promotion of the values and principles of the public service. I think Commissioner Mtembu has already indicated the rationale for why the PSC undertook the study. There were a number of complaints that the PSC received, but also the PSC reacted to a number of newspaper reports in instances where families were left destitute due to failure by the Government Pension Administration Agency to process the pension benefits of some deceased employees or retired public servants. And it was on the basis of that the PSC undertook the study, partly to determine the trend and to establish the reasons for why such delays existed. I think the objectives of the study are directly derived from what the problem statement how the problem statement was explained. But I think beyond that, what the PSC was looking at, it was to try to understand also the roles of the different players, because in a pension payout and a service termination process, there is an employee and their descendants or beneficiaries. There is the government department, there is the agency, but there are other institutions that come into play like SARS. So we wanted to make sure that there is a full understanding of what role is played by which institution as well. We had sampled 40 departments, but obviously we only received cooperation from 28 departments. And of the 9 provinces, only 8 provinces participated. But the PSC is of the view that the information obtained, because there were huge similarities, that the non-participation by the other parties do not compromise the findings. We did collect data not just from secondary information. There was a lot of interviews conducted, especially with HR practitioners and departments and with officials from GIFPA, including the leadership of that institution. We also took site visits to some of the GIFPA offices to talk to some of the people who were there to try to process their pension payouts where there were challenges. There was also an attempt to deal with some of the beneficiaries who were assisted by the PSC, but the challenge with those was once the beneficiaries had received or the pensioners had received their payouts, they became extremely suspicious of the motives of the PSC officials from wanting to get information from them and therefore decided that they do not want to participate. We therefore respected their decisions. In conducting the study, the key findings that we found was that there were challenges with departmental capacity, and that related to HR training. I think to contextualize the issue, we would like to indicate that there would have been training conducted for some HR practitioners, but what the training did not take into account is the attrition rate. When some of those trained people leave the departments or they retire themselves, the incoming employees, there isn't a proper training for those employees, so that on its own would create a problem. As a result, there would be heavy reliance by departments on senior employees to train the incoming ones, but obviously the training itself would not be to the level of quality that would get those people to understand the complexities around service termination. And that is not just about understanding the Public Service Act and the regulations, but it is also about understanding the government employee pensions law and the laws that govern the operations of SARS and how these institutions link up. And obviously we felt that the lack of structured training partly would contribute to some of the problems that would have been identified, especially with problematic forms being submitted, incomplete information being submitted to GPA. The management of the beneficiary profiles, this was one of the challenges that we picked up, that departments in many instances do try to encourage employees on an annual basis to review their beneficiary nomination forms, but there would be employees who are not willing to cooperate with that. The last time they completed the form was when they were going to be loaded on PESAL or registered, but subsequent to that they got married or divorced. A lot of things would happen, but they are not updating their forms. And that on its own becomes a problem because the department and GPA would only rely on what has been signed for and it's on paper. And as a result, you would have those instances where there will be contestations of who should be receiving the benefits because maybe I'm with spouse B now and A is still registered there, or there are now children 3 and 4 but only child 1 is registered, or the last time I entered I put my mother down because I was not married, I didn't have kids, and those then becomes the problems that result in delays. There were also major challenges with records management, only in the cases where there were problems. It's not all across, it's a minor issue, but the challenges were there. Those would be the instances where there is no correlation between what the employee says are their years of service in the public service and the records that GPA has as their years of contribution towards pension. And obviously this problem was much more prevalent with your elderly employees who were transferred from the TVBC state, where the years of service cannot be correlated between GPA, as we know that GPA is an amalgamation of a number of previous pension funds, and there was quite a number of challenges with the transition, with some people either leaving the state and then coming back, or some people being employed at a time when there is no deduction for pension contribution, but because they do not have the first salary slip or the salary slips for those first years, nobody can actually prove that they ever contributed or not. There were customary and civil marriages disputes that were encountered as part of the contribution to delays, and I think we have already indicated this, and this would obviously result in spouses and sometimes even dependents contesting whether the share of what they are getting or what they are not getting is correct or not, because the one party who was supposed to declare and obviously make sure that everybody knows that there is now 2 wives and 6 kids but not 4 has not necessarily done so. And the minute there is a dispute that is registered by one party, GPA stops everything and expects the families to go sort out the issues through the court systems and other matters and bring in a court order that says who should the monies be paid to. And not all the parties normally have the equal economic opportunity to go through those processes. Awareness of service termination and pension payouts. The view was that at least close to 70% of the retirees were well aware and informed of the processes, and those would also constitute the large percentages of people who did not have problems with their pension payouts, but 32% of the retirees claimed that they were not fully informed and they only discovered what the processes were when they started complaining that they are not receiving their payouts and they discovered that they are not they have not either properly completed the forms or there is missing documentation in their submission. So it was from that particular perspective that the PSC arrived at the conclusion that the problem of pension payout and service termination is not as excessive as the PSC thought it is. Feedback communication from GPA to stakeholders. This is one area where we raised as a concern. There were instances where beneficiaries said they did receive information to say there is a problem with your forms, but the issue is GPA only informs you, you have to go back to your employing department because that is where the forms get sent back to go sort out the issues with the assistance of HR because HR needs to guide you on what needs to be fixed. But there would be those instances where a department says, we don't know what GPA is talking about, we never received any information to say there is a problem with those forms. And in a number of instances, obviously, the employees would only receive feedback when they are proactive, trying to find out from the departments or GPA as to what is happening with their payouts. Then one of the challenges, obviously, that was picked up, especially around the forms, it is the e-channel equipment that is being used by GPA. It is a system that was introduced to fast-track the submission of service termination documentation. But there is no compatibility between that system and some of the systems used by departments. Departments must spend their own money to acquire the system so that there is that level of compatibility. And that on its own would end up result in unclear documents being shipped from one department to the other because they'll be trying to scan email instead of using the sophisticated gadget. The structure of departments, and this was largely picked up around your subs, where they are decentralized, the overall process is centralized. However, because these departments operate from regional offices and provinces, documentation gets submitted by an employee to their regional office, it goes to the province, and then it's got to go to national office. We have dealt with similar cases of that nature, including up to September this year, where you discover that the movement of the documentation from the region all the way up to national, which has got the duty to submit to GPA, can take anything between 1 month and 4 months. And in some of those instances, it had to be on the intervention of PSC that the documents were then moved quickly. But again, it needs to be understood that these are some of the biggest departments in the public service. So they could be dealing with lots of forms where at each and every stage there is a verification process. And we have indicated what GPA has tried to do to deal with that issue. And obviously there were other challenges relating to divorce, and these would be instances where there is a court decree that awards 50% of the pension payout to the other party, and there would be contestation around some of those particular cases. We've already spoken about the TVB stays, and then there was the issue of the medical aids. Apparently, according to the government employee pensions law, if you have served 15 years, you qualify for medical aid assistance. But once there is a delay in the processing of your pension, this then overlaps into creating problems for your medical aid benefits, which could then result in your medical aid being cancelled. I think at the level of department, the major issue that we are raising is the refusal of employees to submit or resubmit forms. There are all sorts of superstitions that result in people not wanting to do this, but I think one of the issues that kept on being raised repeatedly is that people felt that if they put a beneficiary or nominate somebody, they might be killed, or it's like they are signing a death warrant for themselves, and all sorts of issues. But the reality of the matter is once the person dies, complications around who should benefit arise, and some of the delays were created by extended family members who would be imposing themselves as the guardians of minor children or as the spokesperson for the elderly family member whose husband has just passed away and so forth. And unfortunately, that is not a terrain that GIPA operates in. It is a terrain where the department, one expects, should be trying to assist by diverting people to the master's, the master's office, which then should assist in determining the rightful beneficiaries. But such advices are not always provided. There is the non-availability at times of the client liaison officers from GIPA, which is an excellent initiative, but some departments were complaining that it doesn't always work well. And really from the side of GIPA, their view was that they have put in a lot of systems in place, but they rely on the CLOs to submit forms to GIPA, or they rely on departments to provide accurate information. All what they do is they detect errors, they detect objections and whatever, and they send documentation back. It is therefore the responsibility of the department to try to resolve those. In terms of the cases that we have dealt with, we discovered that between 2013 and 2016, a lot of the people that we have actually come across have been paid their pension payouts in periods of less than 60 days. So the historic cases largely that the PSC deals with, these are cases of people who joined the state in your 70s and your 80s, and obviously papers that were processed before 2013, before most of the measures were put in place. In terms of the impact of pension payout, irrespective of the fact that we say the problem is not excessively huge, but in terms of the cases that the PSC has looked at, we found that there are these particular challenges where medical aids get cancelled, people cannot send children to school when a spouse dies and they were the sole breadwinner, and the wife or the mother does not know what processes to follow to get these monies paid out. And as a result, some of these retirees or descendants and dependents resort to loan sharks to get money with the hope that when the pension payout comes out, but then that on its own creates major problems for them. So what we are basically saying is the problem seems to have been drastically reduced in the past 3 to 4 years, but the isolated cases remains a matter of concern because of the impact that they have on families. In terms of the roles, obviously we do make recommendations that it is important for departments when they conduct training to make sure that their employees not just understand the public service regulations, but they also understand the processes and the procedures from GIPA, the banks and SARS, because that is where a lot of the errors come in with forms. And I think the recommendations are straightforward. We are requesting for training. We are requesting for GIPA and departments to make a database of all unclaimed pension benefits and try to trace the dependents and the beneficiaries. The law says pension that has not been claimed after 30 years become the property of the state. But if there are people who are suffering in a generation in that 30 years, that poverty migrates to the next generation and so forth. And therefore we are saying they cannot simply fold their arms and saying we are waiting for somebody to come and claim. They also need to be proactive. We are asking that the departments themselves must also be proactive in following up to make sure that pensions are paid out to the right people. Just because an employee has resigned and forms have submitted does not mean the department has completed its task. They need to be 100% sure that there was payment or no payment. And I think we have made the recommendation about the big national departments. that they need to try to decentralize the management of this function to speed up processes. There has to be a level of awareness campaigns, especially involving GEPA and SARS, because some of the delays, especially where an employee passes away, their dependents do not know how to deal with the SARS questions, and that becomes a problem. So it's very, very important that the awareness campaigns, I think in the report we even make a recommendation that where possible for elderly employees who are about to go on pension, maybe departments must ask for permission for those people to bring their young dependents in to attend the training so that there is a good understanding. They must set aside financial resources to upgrade their IT systems if they are going to fast track this thing between GEPA, that is on the part of departments. And we are saying the strategy to communicate with employees needs to be put in place to avoid these instances of GEPA blaming the department and departments blaming GEPA for poor communication on what the problems is with the pension payout. I think overall, the finding is that there are policies, processes and procedures in place, but these are undermined by the human factor on the part of our HR practitioners and the employees themselves due to lack of awareness or lack of cooperation in dealing with matters pertaining to pension or beneficiary nominations whilst they are still alive. And I think more or less that is what brings us to the end of the study. And maybe the last information we can indicate is ever since we completed this report, we have received a lot of other inquiries, possibly less than 300, and some of those were escalated to GEPA. Most of them have been already been paid. But there are instances where there are contestations of beneficiaries that can only be resolved by the court systems, and the feedback has been given to the affected parties to follow the due processes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Honorable members, as the current government, here we are on the issues of pension. But I still want to come back to the issue of double DP. That's why I raised the issue of SASA as well. That I'd like somebody to talk to that. But also double dipping, also public servants also benefiting from the grants. I know in, it was 1998, 1999, government at a local level did try to deal with that one, but only for councillors, but for the public servants, I'm not too sure. I'll start at the bottom of my right.
Thank you. Thank you for this presentation, and Chair, I really want to say I appreciate the fact that this committee has had this presentation, because many public servants have been complaining and have been experiencing huge delays in pension payouts in the past. I've got three questions. The first one is, you know, on retirement, people often need to move. You know, you've been working, let's say, in the Northern Cape for the Department of Agriculture, you've been occupying an official house, you retire, you must now vacate the property, you must move, there are lots of other expenses, and then people find that there are delays, because the apparently the pensions department doesn't want to touch that application before the last day. You must give a month's notice. Well, we all know when you're going to retire, especially if it's due to age, 65. But the admin will only start, you know, after your last day of work. That is the feedback that I've received. Is there no way in which one can say, but listen, we know you're going to retire end of November. We can already, you know, start with the process, so that you don't have to wait a few months before you get your first pension payout. The second one, even if there's an interim payment, yeah, just to help people over that time. The second one is the calculation of the pension amounts. I have been in such a position and I've been unable to ever get the calculation of my pension payout. Do you now provide people with that calculation? If you do provide them, do you do that only on request? And then the last one is, we've just heard that in the resignation process, people can now reverse their resignation. They can retract. Now, also resignation has also got pension implications. And if people can now, up to the very last working day, say, no, I want to continue working for the department, I want to be re-employed, whatever, extend my service, probably the right term to use. How is that going to also affect the administration of the whole pension application process? Because quite often people would like their pensions to be transferred into a new pension fund at their new employer. And it now seems to me as if the change in the public service regulations may also impact on the pension administration. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Ntau.
Thank you, Chair. Just a couple of questions. The first one, is there any relationship between the agency, GEPA, and the Government Employees Pension Fund, if any, and what is it? And the other thing, it's always been brought to my attention by people who are on the Government Employee Pension Fund that they don't get any reports, statements. Most people would get a statement like I get a statement from my pension fund every year. But these people tell me they don't, and I'm just wondering whether there's any reason for that and what should be done for them to get those statements so that they know at least where they stand. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Ntau. Honourable Verma.
Thank you, Chair. Please bear with me. I just need to find my notes for the questions. Chair, last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago, we received a presentation where one of the members said that it's very, very painful when we see all of these things. I think it's also very, very painful for us and for our people. When they retire, they expect a pension, and you need to help them carry on. Or a person passes away, and their family needs to be assisted to carry on. And it seems from what I get here, our government employees, after they've retired, they suffer and they continue suffering. So it's very, very painful to see this. So I really want to ask a couple of things in terms of this. As the Honourable Chairperson said with regard to SASSA, now if I retire, pension doesn't come, I go to SASSA for a grant. But somewhere on the computer system, SASSA sees that I should be getting a pension and they decline my SASSA grant and I can't get a pension for that. And then if in the next foreseeable future I don't get anything, I can't provide for my family. So I think something should really be done about that. Secondly, you said, and we know, what it was like pre-94. The rural areas, they don't have computer systems, not even today. And now I want to ask why. If you see on paper there's a job there, you know, that person has been working there prior to 94, but from 1994 there's paperwork. Why do you not pay the pension so long for after 94 while you still are investigating exactly when that person started prior to 94? I mean, in our rural areas, they don't have the computers or they didn't have it. They lost the paperwork, etc. So you as a department or GEPA as a department, they need to do something to lessen the suffering of the people in those areas. Why are you not doing anything about it? Then now you say that you have an awareness campaign. Now my question is, awareness campaign, who does it reach? Does those awareness campaigns really reach the rural people so that they understand their pensions, their beneficiaries, and whatever, what exactly that means? Yes, And I sit on the DEFSA National Executive Board, and I see the same thing with deaf people who don't put down who their beneficiaries is, and they don't want to because maybe they're superstitious or whatever. But now my concern is that a person puts only the boyfriend's name as a beneficiary, and maybe they're hoping that that boyfriend will take care of their children when they die. Now that boyfriend gets the full pension payout and the children get zero. Now my concern is with what you are saying is that our people are not understanding, our people don't get the information, our people don't have the paperwork. I have a concern with regard to that. And as the previous member said already as well, if you know that you are going to retire this year, doesn't HR nicely, personally call that person in and say, listen, you are retiring. I see the paperwork is not in order. You don't have a SARS number. Assist those employees so that they can get their pension payout. When they retire, we as MPs, you know, and you as government staff, when you retire, you are okay. We're all okay. But the people are not. Now, do something extra that GEPA or something, someone can do to assist our people to make sure that they get their pensions and their families don't suffer. And I see you also said 28 out of 40 departments responded. So meaning 12 departments did not respond. And now my question is, those 12 departments, are those the departments with the problems? Are those the departments with the problems, and why are they not responding? Because HR, does their HR not understand the implications of not responding? Is that why they can't help our own people? So just those couple of questions. Thank you, Chair. Oh, sorry, Chair. One more question. You already said that our people can't afford to go to court. But now I know if somebody passes away without a will, then it goes to the master of the court. Doesn't the master of the court do something, especially when there are children involved? If you can just clarify that. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Dombas.
Thank you, Chairperson.
And thanks for the presentation. Just to add on the question raised by Honourable Velma, the awareness campaigns, what form does it take? How do we make sure that it becomes effective? Do you perhaps have your statistics showing the campaigns that took place recently so that one gets an idea of the extent or the effect of your awareness campaigns? Further than that, Chairperson, after the pension has delayed, to an extent that you find a situation where the beneficiary becomes deceased and the pension comes late thereafter, is there any advice that is given to the next of kin in terms of financial management of those pensions or a way of taking care of the school kids and so on and so on? And then with regard to the, it has to do also with the awareness and the processing of the forms. You spoke, ma'am, about one or two mobile offices. I'm just wondering, with one or two mobile offices with such a vastness of our country, how effective is the whole thing? Maybe there could be an alternative that you can give me for now. Now, once pension has been paid after a very long time, just for argument's sake, is it paid with interest or you just pay what is due to that beneficiary? What happens in that particular case? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, President Tombela. Just to say, while you are going to respond in 2 minutes in all the questions, but also doing the standard one that we receive not later than Thursday, is it Thursday, Friday? Friday, mid-Friday, which is 12, written responses, which will have questions and then the responses. But I'm just saying to all presenters as well. Two is that I'm sure in your response you're aware that also we will need, as the portfolio committee, to invite a government pension fund, because other issues really in terms of other areas, they are the best one, but a joint presentation with them so that we can engage them and better understand their dealings also, even upscaling their, improving their IT system. And I'm sure Dr. Pope, we are taking note that our government department are still believing on papers. And also when we are angry, we ban these buildings and everything disappear. When you are charged also as a senior management, you ban the building. I'm making it's not a proven allegation that I'm making. I'm just making a statement that there is a greater need to move towards also believing in IT and retraining our personnel as it were. Having said that, on the list for written responses as well, it's our relationship which is linked with the IT system, as it may, that there is a smart card that we are introducing, that we are phasing in terms of our citizens. That probably we might need also to prioritize our public servants so that the information also then is an issue of updating that information at an interval basis. I think you can develop a program that you can talk to that to remind you to say you need also to do the headcount of the personnel. Actually, we are dealing with multiple things when you are doing that, but at a 2-year, whatever that is feasible and financially feasible as it may. The other one from my side that they've asked the questions of welfare of families. Also, you spoke to that one. I've spoken to the issue of the system also automatically. But also what I would love also when we are coming back with the government pension fund is to prioritize those departments which have got more public servants in terms of numbers and see the magnitude of challenges that we have discovered and see how best can we intervene on that one. The last one, honorable members, which I'm dealing also with the recommendations at the same time as I'm talking, is the recommendations that today when we are going to notice the recommendations, because we don't correct. So in terms of minutes, must reflect that so that we can really present the recommendations in our next meeting for us so that they can find intercession to the House, where it needs also to go to NCOP if it does happen. But over to you, ma'am, and it's 2 minutes still.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. I'll briefly just touch on the generic questions. I think some of the straightforward ones will be handwritten. The rules around pension payouts is an employee can either apply for a full payout or they can apply for a one-third with a monthly benefit. And we have discovered instances where people applied for the full payout not being aware, or they apply for the one-third and then it comes with the monthly payments, but they then compare themselves to say that one got 1 million, I got 300, but they forget that the arrangements differ. But then the complicating factor around the one-third is if you are still alive, you receive the monthly payout for 5 years and you die afterwards, your family does not get anything. Those are the rules. But if you die before the 5 years, the remaining period of the 5 years will then be paid out to your beneficiaries. If you opt for the one-third lump sum payout with the other two-thirds being spread into your monthly payouts for as long as you live, if you are paid those monthly payouts for 5 years and you pass on after 5 years, nothing goes to your family. The contractual obligation with pension and yourself and your beneficiary has ended. But if you die before the 5 years, they will calculate the benefit of the balance and then give that to you. These are called the defined benefits. The way this pension is calculated is they look at your last pay salaries multiplied by the numbers of years that you have served. So in essence, it tends to benefit people than what you get in the private sector that looks at your actual contributions. So it's all a question. The numbers game is in your last pay versus the numbers of years. And this is the part that sometimes people don't understand, that you might have worked for 43 years, but still earning something like 50,000. It's only in your last maybe financial year or so that your salary goes up, and that is not the 3 years enough that allows the highest multiplication factor. If I can go to the other question on SASSA, there is a formula that SASSA uses for determining whether a pensioner can qualify for SASSA. There is a threshold of how much you should earn to qualify for a pro rata SASSA pension or not. If you are above that threshold, you will not get anything, but if you are below, they will calculate the percentage and allow you to get that. So from our experience of having dealt with a number of these cases, is that often people from your teaching profession and nursing who retired at very low salary levels, they would qualify for those pro ratas depending on how much they are getting per month. But there is a complication. If you go for the full takeout of your pension, you approach SASSA in your own individual capacity. And if they think you were at a level where you worked and you had enough, you will not qualify for SASSA at all. But if your lump sum was still very low, SASSA can still consider you for pension benefit. So it's very, very strict and highly controlled. I think on the mobile units, very quickly, I think we do mention that in the report. For large areas, remember SASSA also has got regional offices, but for large areas with remote areas, they have one or two mobile units that is in the provinces where they try to map out the routes with the provincial administration as to where these units will be going to try to engage with public servants and the community. But they don't do it alone. They piggyback on the mobile units that government uses for community development workers, Social Department of Social Development, and so forth. So it's within that particular context that these particular initiatives are undertaken. From some of the people we met in the call centers, this is how they knew how to approach GIPA if they were experiencing problems from attending these MBZOs. But I think we also know that sometimes the attendance of these engagements is not as high as we would like it to be. So from where we are sitting, we think they have put in a lot of systems and mechanisms in place to reach out to the people. I think the issue of the Masters Court, we tried very hard to engage with GIPA to say who triggers the action of the Masters Court. When there is a beneficiary list and the dependents are minors, it is automatic GIPA will engage. Yes, I'm just doing the last one. But if there are no beneficiaries listed, or the beneficiary listed is my mother and I have kids, GIPA does not know. They will process the payment unless somebody interjects and say, no, this person did not declare everything. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. I think we have honorable members benefited. That will bring us to the end of our presentation. And we are in terms of our agenda, the minutes, we are not going to be able to deal with them because we are not correcting, but which means we will double them the last week and this week, next week. Definitely we'll start with the minutes, adopting the minutes first before any other business of the day or next week. Is it next week? No, next week, yes, yeah, because the subcommittee meets on Tuesday, yeah. No, we're done. There's no break. No, we're done. Thank you so much. Have a good week. See you in the house. Those of us will be in the house, and don't be funny in the house, please. Thank you so much.
No, I'm just laughing. I had a warning, but fortunately the call is for later than this time, so I didn't have to leave them.
Oh no, that's fine. But thanks so much for your attendance, honourable members and colleagues. If I say colleagues, I mean the administration part. Thank you. Sure. Bye. The meeting is adjourned.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You know what? I think me and you still need to have time. Some of these conversations, although we don't need the conversations, there could be a problem coming out of them.
A problem.
Even for my public here. We can make this committee today. I'll try and bring my thoughts together, then we can send notes. They want to. Wait, I was making
five one four
Oh, I'm
tired.
No, that's what happened today, the other day, I downplayed because I'm full better than I got it. Because I checked my comments and my inside, I couldn't do myself acting there, it's not. I've just been acting for quite some time now.
Responsibility, Jacob has risen.
No, it has. You know, it can't hepatic.
Besides, it is important to prime it into a particular.
No, this one, because whatever, if the Democratic Committee goes down, women get down. But I think,
so,
no,
we are not looking at it as such, but we are looking at the added responsibility. Yeah, I don't think anything wrong if they just require. They are not demanding an inquiry in the investment, but their advice is very important.
Because as you go, let me tell you where I'm going, my face is gone.
Hey.
It's an exposure in Mandelimu. It's an exposure in Mandelimu. So now I'm benefiting. It's just that care if I say yes to the
should be blocked in that particular.
Actually, I think we're not a caring Lokuza. Because like it last week.
Hello, doctor.
Hi, how are you? I think on this point of... The evening wanted to come with us. We have been invited. It's not you.
And tonight will only be at 9. And her mother, staying with us.
Oh, wow.
So she asked me to, because mother is 9.
Yeah.
They only get up at 9 o'clock.
Oh,
no. So I invite her to bring this birthday. It's only one early year that you must, and I don't know if she will be with us. And I don't know if she will be with us next year. I don't know, because her health is not good.
I'm trying to ask the question.